From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now. The legal battle over abortion rights did not end with Friday's Supreme Court ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade. Just the opposite. The landmark ruling has triggered moves to restrict abortions as soon as possible in some states and moves to strengthen abortion rights in others. And that's giving rise to a complicated and potentially confusing patchwork of laws that vary state to state. And legal experts are expecting new cases to emerge as states that outlaw the procedure try to make their bans apply beyond their borders. We're turning to Rachel Rabushe, who is a professor of law and the interim dean of Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Rachel, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Earlier this year, a lawmaker in Missouri introduced an amendment that would create civil liability for anybody who helps another person travel out of state to get an abortion. That bill did not become law. But are you expecting states that have banned abortion to also try to restrict access to abortion in other states?
I think so. I think that there are already mumblings that proposed legislation, once trigger laws and other laws are in effect, banning abortion within a state, that some states will seek to punish providers who provide abortions to their citizens, their residents outside of the state. There are constitutional problems with that approach. I think some of that legislation will end up in court, end up in litigation, but I certainly think that we can expect to see states try.
And there, we should say that there are states that have different laws about many things. Adult recreational marijuana use, it's legal in some states, but not in others. Gambling, same thing. So how would laws work that prevent someone from seeking an abortion where it is legal?
It would be a huge inroad to some of the assumptions we have as Americans about how we travel in this country. If gambling is illegal in my state and I go to Vegas for the weekend, I don't expect to be punished when I come back. And so it's not certain that a court would hold that a state has a power to apply its policies outside of its borders, but it's a very unsettled area of law, and it's particularly not settled as it applies to abortion.
So there are a lot of questions about the extraterritorial reach of the ban. Texas's law banning abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy, with no exception for rape or incest, that's known as SB 8, makes it legal for a private citizen to sue other private citizens and abortion providers if they suspect someone has performed an abortion or helped someone access abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. This is civil, not criminal litigation, and has basically shut down abortion access in Texas. There are other states that have modeled bans on this law. Do you see this kind of civil litigation as being used in other ways by states to restrict abortion?
I think that civil litigation could be a part of state strategies to try to ban abortion within their borders and outside their borders. We'll see criminal bans, of course, but I think there's nothing to stop a state like Missouri from also using civil penalties as another way to enforce its abortion policies. And so I think states are already thinking about those kinds of strategies, and they raise really important questions about jurisdiction, about how that provider might actually be liable to civil penalties, and what happens if, for instance, a Missouri court enters a default judgment against a provider for providing services that are legal in that provider's state. Those are just the tip of the iceberg of some of the complicated questions, made even more complicated by the efforts of New York, Connecticut, other states that are attempting to shield their providers from penalties, civil and criminal, if they are providing legal abortions within their own states.
Is there no clear precedent on this issue?
For cross-border bans, there are a couple of cases that the Supreme Court has decided decades ago, but they really had more to do with prohibiting communication about abortion, information about abortion services. So it was dealt with in a First Amendment context. The Missouri Supreme Court, speaking of Missouri, heard a case that considered whether or not the state could stop people from taking minors outside of the state for the purpose of avoiding parental involvement laws. And in that case, the Missouri Supreme Court said that it didn't believe that Missouri could attach its laws to people leaving the state. It's an unsettled area of law, but there are good reasons to think that cross-border laws would be unconstitutional.
Abortion pills are also an option for people. They can be mailed. They can be mailed from a place like New York to a place like Texas with very different laws. Do you expect states to try to restrict abortion pills from crossing state lines?
I think that's what we can expect. I think the fact that now that the FDA permits certified providers to mail pills, there's just a number of different avenues in which pills will become more portable. And I think we can expect states that have abortion bans to target that portability. And my fear is that in so doing, states might turn their attention to punishing patients, whereas now they focus on providers. I worry that the will to police how pills travel will end up in states targeting patients.
And lots more to talk about eventually on the legal landscape. Thank you very much, Rachel Rabushey, Professor of Law and Interim Dean of Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Thanks again.
Thank you.
This weekend, dozens of Russian missiles struck targets across Ukraine, including in the capital Kyiv and the city of Lviv, which endured the heaviest attacks in months. The escalation by Russian forces ended weeks of relative quiet across the northern and western parts of Ukraine. With G7 and NATO summits taking place this week, the attacks this weekend ensured that the war in Ukraine would be front and center in the discussions at both gatherings. NPR security correspondent Greg Myrie joins us from Ukraine. Greg, good to have you.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
So Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, addressed President Biden and other G7 leaders at a meeting today in the Bavarian Alps. What was his message?
Right. So he spoke by video link from here in Kyiv, and the actual speech hasn't been released, but the details that are coming out is that he really stressed the need for heavy weapons very soon. He really wants Ukraine to try to get the upper hand on the battlefield before the end of the year. And the Russians have been making these slow, incremental advances. They have more firepower. And Ukraine's big worry is maintaining Western unity and support and military assistance. And they worry that the longer this fight grinds on, the harder it may be to maintain that. So they really want to stress the urgency.
Right. Now, the U.S. and other NATO countries have been sending weapons throughout the war. What specifically are the Ukrainians looking for at this point?
The top priority is really long-range artillery, and it has been arriving, but just not in the quantity or at the speed Ukraine would like. Perhaps the best example of this is the long-range U.S. rocket system known as HIMARS. Now, these systems have arrived recently. They've been placed on the battlefield. Ukraine's military even put out a slick video over the weekend saying it had just started using them, showing some of them being fired on the battlefield. They can strike it up to 40 miles away, which is much further than previous systems that Ukraine had. We've seen reports already that Russian military sites 30 miles or more from the front lines are being hit, suggesting these HIMARS are doing what they're supposed to do. Now, the Biden administration just pledged 4 of these systems initially, but it now says more are in the pipeline.
I see. So, as we mentioned, the capital city, Kyiv, where you are, was hit by Russian missiles over the weekend. My understanding, it has been fairly quiet there recently. So, can you talk a little bit about the significance of this latest attack?
Sure. You know, the Russians pulled back from the outskirts of Kyiv back at the end of March, almost 3 months ago, and the attacks on the capital have been very rare since then. But on Sunday, an apartment building in central Kyiv got hit by a missile. One person was killed, several injured. This was part of a nationwide barrage over the weekend. More than 60 missiles struck around the country, many in the north and the west, the areas that have been relatively quiet. Now, Russia seemed to be sending a message here with this G7 meeting taking place today and a NATO meeting scheduled tomorrow. And just today, the Russians hit a busy shopping center in the central city of Kramatchuk, killing several people as well.
Terrible. Greg, we've just passed the 4-month mark of the Russian invasion. Give us a quick sort of overview of the state of this war today.
Right. So most analysts say the trend lines are pointing toward some sort of standoff coming up in the coming weeks or months. Russia has been making these limited gains in very heavy fighting in the eastern part of the country. It does seem to have the momentum in terms of day-to-day fighting. It does have more firepower. Now, that said, Ukraine aggressively contests every Russian attempt to advance. Russia is having to concentrate its firepower in one small area for weeks and weeks to make even these very limited advances. So the expectation is we're going to see more fighting, particularly in the eastern region, the Donbass region, and Russia wants to get a firm control of that area. But neither side really appears to be capable of a major breakthrough. Again, there's no sign of peace talks, so the expectation is more fighting, no real prospect of peace talks.
The war grinds on. NPR's Greg Myrie in Kyiv. Thanks so much for your reporting, Greg. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
There's a struggle going on over the investigation into the death of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was killed last month as she was covering an Israeli army operation in the occupied West Bank. Investigations by the UN Human Rights Office and several media outlets all say an Israeli soldier likely killed her. Israel says it's still looking into the death, and the U.S. has called for a transparent investigation. NPR's Daniel Estrin has been following the story from Jerusalem. Hi, Daniel.
Thanks for having me, Lisa.
Remind us about the circumstances of this journalist's death.
Shireen Abu Akleh was really well known to her viewers on Arabic language Al Jazeera and known worldwide to viewers covering the violence and the conflict that has been going on for decades in the Palestinian territories. People here in the Palestinian territories would watch Al Jazeera to find out what was going on in their own backyards, and they would watch her and her coverage. Now, the story that she was covering, the context is that there had been weeks of Palestinian attacks in Israel and Israeli army incursions and arrests in Palestinian areas. And she was covering one of those Israeli arrest raids in the Jenin refugee camp. She was with a group of journalists. She was wearing a vest clearly marked with the English word press, and she was shot.
There were other reporters around at the time, though, who said that they were being fired at as well. Is it clear that this particular journalist was being isolated, being targeted?
What is clear from media investigations from the New York Times, the Washington Post, others, as well as the UN Human Rights Office, which did their own inquiry, they have reviewed evidence of video footage, audio, and the location, the known locations of Palestinian gunmen versus Israeli soldiers. They've all said that the evidence points to the likelihood that it was an Israeli soldier who shot her. Israel says it's not clear if it was a Palestinian gunman or an Israeli soldier, and they're still investigating. Israel says what's clear is that she was not targeted intentionally by any Israeli soldier. But Israel has not said how it's reached that conclusion. Israel, we do know, has questioned the suspected soldier and has retrieved his weapon. We don't know what that soldier told Israeli investigators. We don't know what his orders were. And we still need to see evidence and hear answers about the circumstances of that shot and was it intentional. Israel says it wasn't.
Why would this happen now and why to this specific journalist?
Well, her family, Shireen Abu Akleh's family, say that they can't understand it any other way but that she was targeted for her reports, that she was silenced by Israel. Israel says that they are committed to freedom of the press and that she was not targeted directly. But you have to understand this from the context that, unfortunately, there are Palestinian casualties that happen very frequently when Israeli soldiers are conducting incursions in Palestinian areas. And so the question now is when Israel will continue its own investigation and whether there will be any kind of definitive answers of who shot her and what the intentions were. Palestinians refuse a joint investigation with Israel. Israel says, we cannot determine the facts without the bullet. Palestinian officials refused to submit the bullet for a joint investigation. And when I spoke with Shireen Abu Akleh's brother, he said, how can you expect a suspect to investigate this objectively. He wants the evidence submitted to the U.S. for a U.S.-led investigation. She was also a U.S. dual citizen. But the State Department says the U.S. is not about to be investigating this. The U.S. wants Israelis and Palestinians to be sharing evidence. So we're back at square one. And the question is, will there be any breakthrough in Israel's own investigation for it to present answers?
The reason the Palestinians have the bullet is that she was in Palestinian territory, and that's where the bullet was extracted from her body.
That's right. Palestinian investigators did their own forensic investigation, retrieved the bullet, but Israel says without matching the soldier's rifle to the bullet, it cannot decisively determine that it was a soldier who shot her. But I've spoken to military experts, one of Ner Gvaryahu, a former sniper in the Israeli army, who says Israel has more information it has not released. It's not just a question of the bullet. What did the suspected soldier say? What were his orders? What other footage might the Israeli army have of that incident? We don't know the answers to that. And he is part of an organization that called Breaking the Silence, which interviews other former Israeli soldiers about what they saw and what they did during their service. And he says there's a long history of shortcomings when it comes to investigations of Palestinian civilian casualties when the Israeli army is involved. So this is part of a long history of Palestinian civilian casualties and not very many prosecutions of soldiers.
NPR's Daniel Estrin speaking to us from Jerusalem. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, let's switch gears here. What are you watching for fun and some much-needed distraction these days? Well, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has ideas for some new shows, freshly picked for your viewing pleasure. Eric Deggans says they're all worth watching, and he's with us now. Eric, great to have you.
Hey, yeah, you know, after watching, you know, hearings on TV, and, you know, Supreme Court decisions, you know, maybe you need to unwind a little bit with some TV.
Totally agree. So let's start with Loot on Apple TV+. In the first episode, Maya Rudolph's character throws herself into a charity she forgot she founded after divorcing her cheating husband, and that doesn't thrill the charity director. Let's listen.
Look, I'm not trying to shame a girl for having a good time, especially after what happened. You do you, but you can't go traveling around the world getting on the news for falling into swimming pools.
Lots of people fall into swimming pools all the time.
Yeah, but they don't then get out and try to give the waiter a lap dance.
In my defense, I really did think it was Sting. They have this same hairline when you're on drugs.
Eric, Rudolph can be so funny. She's stolen plenty of scenes across her career. How does she do here?
You know, it's interesting because this seems to be kind of based on, you know, maybe what Melinda Gates might have gone through. It starts with her husband. She's having a birthday party. You know something's going to go wrong with this relationship, right? But the way this cast kind of tells this story is just so interesting and engaging and funny that I find myself really enjoying it, even though I kind of had a sense I knew where the story was going.
Well, in that clip we just heard, I just love this line. Lots of people fall into swimming pools all the time, and the charity director responds, yeah, but they don't get out and try to give the waiter a lap dance.
Exactly. Just when you think her character has kind of learned her lesson, she always takes it to the next level, you know.
All right. So that's Loot on Apple TV Plus, starring Maya Rudolph. Let's talk about this FX show, The Bear. It's streaming on Hulu. It's about a young man leaving the fine dining world to take over a humble sandwich shop. Now, you might expect that shop to be bear-themed, but no, it's called The Original Beef of Chicagoland. So, Eric, why is this show called The Bear?
Well, the lead character is played by this wonderful actor, Jeremy Allen White, and the character's name is Carmen Bearzado. So that nickname sort of comes from their last name.
I see.
You know, one of the most interesting parts about this show is the way they show this kitchen and how chaotic it is and how, you know, Carmen is struggling to bring the strategy and processes of a fine dining establishment to, you know, a family-owned kind of neighborhood kitchen.
Yo! Somebody come try this, cousin!
Yeah, right!
That was a present.
There you go, chef. Chef,
It's redundant and wide, just like you.
Heard.
All right, sounds pretty exciting in there.
So basically, he comes in there, and one of the things he insists is that they all call each other chef as a sign of respect. And these folks who've been sort of essentially slinging hash for years, they're not having it, you know?
Yeah, so, interesting.
It's one of the best shows of the summer, and I really highly recommend everybody check it out.
Oh, well, that's a strong recommendation. Eric, I'm curious, without giving too much away, does Carmen manage to impose fine dining values on a short order establishment with any success?
Well, what I'll say is there's a meeting of the minds. Not okay. Quite halfway, you know, but they do have to kind of meet each other.
Okay. Finally, Eric, let's talk about HBO's Westworld, which returns for its fourth season. For folks who haven't seen this is a show about androids that were created for a Wild West theme park. But the story has really evolved since it began. So, Eric, what do fans need to know about the fourth season? Will they be happy to tune in for this one?
I have no idea because this show is so complicated. So Westworld, of course, started out in the first season about this sort of amusement park that had these artificial people in it where people could go and sort of pretend to be in the Wild West or whatever. Those artificial people actually gained consciousness. They became alive. And they began to rebel against the humans who were abusing them. Now, the fourth season starts, and all the key characters are in different places now. And part of the fun of watching the first episode is trying to figure out, like, why are they in this place and what are they doing? So I don't want to spoil that. But eventually, everyone realizes that there is another malevolent force out there that is trying to assert control. And so I think we'll see a lot of the fourth season sort of focused on the effort to stop that.
All right. Well, that's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking about some great and interesting and fun stuff to watch on TV. We all need some distraction and a little bit of fun, especially these days. Eric, thanks for your advice. We always appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Many economists are talking about the threat of a potential recession within the next year. There is soaring inflation, and the Federal Reserve has been taking aggressive steps to try to address the problem. Earlier this month, it approved its biggest interest rate hike in decades. But CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger says there are some upsides to a potential downturn. The host of Jill on Money is with us now, eager to hear about those potential upsides, Jill. Lots of people are talking about a recession on the way. The Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said it is not inevitable, but she does expect to see the economy slow down. How do you see it?
Well, I think that no matter what, we are seeing a slowdown as we speak. And that is partially because consumers and businesses are spending less money. So that slows things down a little bit. That we're spending money on gas, can't spend it elsewhere in the economy. And also because the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. And, you know, there's no way to come out of this without slowing down. That is the actual intent of rising interest rates. So here's the good news. The boring parts of your financial life are going to come back into vogue once again. And let me start by saying that every single one of us who went through the pandemic, and we all did, now knows the value of an adequate emergency reserve fund. And what is adequate? It is 6 to 12 months of your living expenses in a boring old savings, checking, money market, or short-term CD. That kind of safety net can give you such peace of mind as the economy slows down or even potentially goes into a recession.
So if we are talking about a deep and maybe brief recession, we're also talking about a job market that's on fire. Are these kinds of swings the new normal?
I'm not going to say the new normal. I'm just going to say this is where we are today. Often in a recession, there is a potential drop-off in the labor market. Now, the strange thing is as you note, the labor market has been extraordinarily hot. I think that idea actually gives you some time to take stock of what's going on in your work life. So, for example, we know that there are more than 11 million job openings right now. Before you make the leap and say, I'm just going to go and take a new job, remember, if we get a slowdown, oftentimes the last people into an organization are the first ones to go if things turn south. Also, Do you have some great benefits right now that you're not taking advantage of? For example, we know that a lot of employers are providing some educational support. Maybe this job that you have right now, even though it doesn't pay quite as much, you like it. You like the people you work with. That's worth a lot, especially when you think about what could happen in the future.
So you say, I mean, those are really interesting ideas. You're saying instead of just kind of sitting back and being under the covers, you can actually take certain actions. What can you do to future-proof your job in your career?
Well, I think that very critically look at what your job is and where you could go if in the event of something bad happens. So that means you got to fire up that network. Isn't that annoying? I'm like an Uber networker. Like, I love networking, which is just talking
to
my friends.
Doesn't surprise me, Jill.
I know, right? I mean, really. So I'm going to say that for someone like me, this is not a big deal, but for the shy person out there, it can be really daunting. But I want to encourage you to not think of it as networking. Just think like touching base with my pals, because the hard thing is, when things do turn south, and they will at some point, it's hard to start from scratch. So you want to do something now, because things do turn quite quickly. And those who are acting in advance of a downturn, I think, will be paid back handsomely for doing so.
Always interesting. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News. She's the host of Jill on Money. Thank you, Jill.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Thousands of people in India have been protesting government plans to cut military spending. A scheme called Agnipath, also known as Path of Fire, offers recruits shorter contracts and less benefits. But with youth unemployment reaching staggering levels, the response to the proposals have been violent. Raksha Kumar reports from Mumbai.
Breaking news that's coming in right now. Bihar cracks down on Agnipath protesters. In states
across India, protesters have spilled out onto the streets. Trains have been set on fire, roads blocked, cars overturned. Thousands have been arrested and at least one person has died. This furious reaction was inspired by government proposals aimed at cutting the military's ballooning personnel and pension bills. Under the scheme, recruits aged up to 23 would be brought into the army on four-year contracts. Only a quarter of these would be retained afterwards.
One of the 10 largest employers in the world.
As this army recruitment video boasts, a career in the Indian military used to offer a pathway to economic stability.
The Indian Army. Live a life less ordinary.
But under the Agnipath proposals, career options for young Indians, especially in rural areas, are looking increasingly ordinary. This young protester asks, what are we supposed to do after 4 years? Prime Minister Narendra Modi has defended the decision. He came into office in 2019, promising to double the size of India's economy by 2024. And while the economy has expanded, job creation has been decidedly lackluster. Economist Ritira Khera says not everyone benefits from it.
The economy is growing, and job opportunities are getting created, or work opportunities rather, are getting created. Much of it is happening in the unorganized sector, where conditions of employment are very poor, insecure, poorly paid.
A career in the armed forces used to be more than just a route out of poverty. It was about prestige and stability. But for many now, it looks like that escape route is firmly blocked. For NPR News, I'm Raksha Kumar in Mumbai.
Today is National HIV Testing Day, a day meant to encourage people to learn their HIV status and get treatment if they need it. HIV is the human immunodeficiency virus, and if untreated, it can lead to AIDS. HIV testing and treatment options have come a long way since the start of the AIDS epidemic 4 decades ago, but HIV advocates say they still face challenges fighting a disease that has claimed the lives of more than 700,000 Americans. Colorado Public Radio's Vic Vella reports.
Kent Brown, Richard Locke.
It's a soggy and somber June afternoon in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, where more than 3,000 panels of the National AIDS Quilt are on display. It's the quilt's 35th anniversary, and dozens of people are lined up at a podium to read names of those who have died of AIDS.
Michael Pratt, Ray Schoenberger.
That's Tommy Sherwood, who says he's lost 50 loved ones to AIDS. 50. Sherwood's been living with HIV since the 1980s, a time of great despair for many gay men in America.
It was terrifying.
And Joe Cullen.
I remember one morning I was living with one of my best friends, and he came to my bedroom and opened the door, which was a little unusual. And he said, "Tommy, you've got to see this." And it was the first report in the New York Times about some diseases that were hitting gay men. And we both looked at each other and said, "Something terrible's coming."
Sherwood's premonition was spot on.
It's mysterious, it's deadly, and it's baffling medical science. Acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Once thought to affect only promiscuous homosexual males, AIDS is now spreading in epidemic proportions to other segments of the population.
And at the time, AIDS was likely a death sentence.
There was a lot of fear, there was a lot of panic and anxiety.
Cliff Morrison was the AIDS coordinator at San Francisco General Hospital's 5B, the world's first AIDS ward. He said it's important to remember those who passed away as people, not statistics. Morrison's best friend was a 5B nurse who died of AIDS in 1992.
Wayne Zito was eccentric, to say the least. He was a party boy. He loved to have a good time. That was his whole life. Oh, I remember he made me laugh. Yeah, that was really important.
Richard Bourgeois, Frank Carroll, Michael Hibbard.
The U.S. has come a long way since those devastating early days of the AIDS epidemic. Today's treatment options give people with HIV a chance to live long, healthy lives. Guillermo Chacon heads the Latino Commission on AIDS.
If you have HIV and you have access to treatment and you stay in treatment, you will be undetectable to HIV. That is, to me, the big home run.
People who reach undetectable status cannot transmit HIV. And nowadays, you can take a medication called PrEP, which reduces the chances of getting HIV from sex by 99%. The CDC says that annual infections in the U.S. have been reduced by more than two-thirds since the mid-1980s. But significant challenges remain, especially among minority groups. Here's Chacon.
The people that are using right now, they are taking advantage of this amazing medication. But when you look who's accessing that, are not Latinos and Black.
Blacks and Latinos continue to be disproportionately affected by HIV. The most recent CDC data shows that these groups account for the largest increases in new HIV diagnoses. Grizel Howard leads the Black AIDS Institute.
In our community, uniquely, specifically in an unapologetic Black community, we still are remedial in our HIV knowledge, in our HIV fluency, in our HIV practices. And we are, because we're still so remedial, we're not holding our key community influences and stakeholders and messengers accountable.
Howard and Chacon say people need more access to and education around testing. About 13% of people living with HIV don't even know they have it. Access to good health care and life-saving medications is another big obstacle for many. For African Americans, Howard says HIV education efforts need to start at the beginning.
You cannot get HIV from sharing, using the same commode. You cannot get HIV from drinking after someone. However, you can get HIV from having unprotected sex, from using the same needle. Let's get back to real public health messaging.
But while there's still challenges, HIV advocates remain hopeful for the future. Chacon says he's heartened by President Biden's goal to end HIV in the U.S. by 2030. And he's happy that Harold Phillips, a Black man living with HIV, now leads the White House Office of National AIDS Policy.
Meaning that they talk about housing, they talk about going deeper on confronting homophobia, stigma. They talk about aiming to reach racial and ethnic justice from a health perspective that I think is unique, because I keep telling people, if we don't talk about race, we're not there.
Dan A, Violet B, Eugene C.
Back at the AIDS Quilt event in San Francisco, Alex Thornton is seen standing over a section of quilt panels, wiping away tears.
I was thinking of my friends who are still living with HIV and who don't have access to health care. And I don't want to see their names here. You know, the first panel was 1987, and we're still adding panels, and we're still here.
The last thing Thornton wants to do is read the names of his own friends at the next memorial. For Here and Now, I'm Vic Vella.
We'd like to hear from you for a story we're working on. This country is facing a huge shortage of labor. One consequence is that teenagers will be in demand for summer jobs. If you're a teenager, tell us if you're taking the plunge into the hot job market. And if you're not looking for a job, what are your summer plans? Visit hereandnow.org to share your story with us. And if you're a parent, let us know if your teenager wants to weigh in. Again, it's hereandnow.org. We are officially living in the post-Roe era, and it's not yet clear what the full consequences of that new reality will be. The Supreme Court's decision could do more than end the constitutional right to abortion. It could also introduce new restrictions to the fertility industry. For more, let's bring in Derek Thompson. You are staff writer at The Atlantic, and joining us by Skype, you are looking at one particular aspect of this. So 3 days after the end of Roe, how are you thinking about the ruling and where we find ourselves now?
Well, I think the judicial implications of this are fascinating. The political implications of it are obviously fascinating. But I'm really interested in the fertility aspect of this ruling. So I think there's a lot of people that are pro-life and also pro-fertility. They not only oppose abortion, but they also tend to have lots of children and support people having lots of children. And I'm very interested in the way that the end of the regime of Roe versus Wade could actually ironically hurt fertility in America, make people less likely to have kids. On the one hand, you could imagine rather obviously that it might reduce sex between people who are not married, and sex rates in the US are already in structural decline. And I'm also really interested in the way that it could affect IVF, in vitro fertilization, which is a very popular way for people who struggle to have children naturally to have children by essentially creating embryos in a lab and then transferring those embryos to the woman so that she can bear the child. I think it's going to be really interesting if you essentially have some states say that based on a reading of Dobbs in a post-Roe America, it is illegal to destroy embryos in a lab, just as it is illegal in some states, many states now, to destroy an embryo within a body. That's what it means to ban abortions. And I think that it's really going to be a touchy subject if some states start to think about banning IVF, a procedure that is absolutely essential for thousands and thousands of couples to have children.
So what do you think the ultimate impact will be with the end of Roe on IVF, on the industry, which you said is extraordinarily important?
Well, I do think that at the moment, a lot of Republicans, even those who are pretty severely, or I should say extremely pro-life, do say they want to preserve infertility care. So it's not obvious that dozens of states right now are going after IVF. What I think is interesting is imagining the ways that some of the laws that they pass could be, you know, used by some people to try to ban IVF. So, for example, you know, you have a state, let's say it's Missouri, you know, Dakota, that has a law on the books that bans abortion. There might be, call them, you know, activist lawyers or activist groups that try to sue IVF clinics based on a conservative or radical reading of that law. And that could have some kind of chilling effect, I think, on IVF clinics, because now they have to pay for a lot of legal coverage. That's maybe one sort of low-level way that you could see a Dobbs future impacting IVF. More strongly, there's really no telling exactly how far this revolution to the right in terms of abortion is going to go. You know, many years ago, people were saying, in fact, Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch were telling sitting senators, we have no intent of overruling Roe versus Wade. Well, look how far that got us. So when there are certain Democrats, certain Republicans that say that they have no desire to overturn infertility care, you know, maybe we should take them sincerely, or maybe we should wait 2 years.
You've been talking about the fertility industry. Let's talk about corporations. Goldman Sachs, BuzzFeed, Warner Brothers, and a number of other companies
announced that they will cover travel expenses for their employees who are seeking abortions if they need to leave the state to get the procedure. It's worth noting that some of these companies fund Republican causes even while they're taking a liberal stance on other issues, including this one. What's the line they're trying to toe?
I remain absolutely fascinated by the fact that there are many corporations in America that donate to Republicans while talking like Democrats. So they will give money to Republican PACs. But when you look at the policies that they're most public about, you've got a company like Disney, which comes out against the Don't Say Gay law in Florida. You have companies now like Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Tesla. These are not companies that one typically associates with the far left, for sure. But they have all come out to say that they will subsidize or reimburse employees traveling from states where abortions are banned to states where abortions are legal. This is a really fascinating development where, the way I see it, a lot of Democrats see their party at the national level as doing close to nothing. And so they treat the companies that employ them as Democrats by proxy. The Democratic Party's proxy agent in America right now, for many people, is corporate America. And that's a very interesting evolution when you think about the fact that corporate America does not exactly act like a Democrat when it comes to their earnings policy, their regulatory policy. We're in a really fascinating moment when it comes to corporate activism.
But you're saying also that the money is going to Republican causes.
That's right. Yeah, well, exactly. Donate like Republicans, talk like Democrats. This is a tension that either will not be resolved, and so the hypocrisy will simply remain naked for many, many years, or it will be resolved because a lot of companies, pressured by their liberal employees, will stop donating to Republicans or perhaps donating entirely.
That's Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thank you, as always, Derek.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now.